Hello, welcome to Sunday Profile. I'm Richard Addy. Today, to them that have, more shall be given. Life isn't fair, especially when it comes to health. For starters, you can't pick your parents, and that means your genes aren't something you have any say about. Then there's your lot in life. So how well off your family is, what kind of diet you have, how much education you get, and of course, how much you go on to earn. All of them have an impact. What's surprising is that status has an impact too. So how you're regarded by other people affects your health. And this turns out to be measurable within the same organisation. The high status people at the top have better health than those in the middle, and they have better health than those at the bottom. Power and autonomy make a difference. All of these factors, from diet and education through to status, are what's called social determinants. And the man who worked out what impact they have on health is Sir Michael Marmot of University College London. So, how important are they?
Health inequalities and the social determinants of health are not a footnote to the determinants of health. They are the main issue.
So more important than genes. I know we're still learning a lot about genes and epigenetics and the like, but is it more important?
Well, yes and no. Think about height. Height is probably 95% genetic, but that's not actually very interesting. What's much more interesting is the increase in height that has occurred over the 20th century. And it may only be a small part of the total variability, but it's the really interesting part because it's the part we really can do something about.
Insofar as this relates to social environment, poverty, say, it seems very intuitive. If you're poor, you don't eat as well, you don't have access to the best health care or education. But you have found that there's more to it. Not only does absolute disadvantage matter, relative disadvantage matters.
Absolutely, and that's very important because the default position of social policy in certainly the English-speaking world is that we should focus on the worst off. But what we've shown in study after study, in country after country, that there's a social gradient, and by that I mean the lower you are in the hierarchy, the worse your health. The higher you are, the better your health. So it's not just that people with no education have worse health. People with a bit of education, it's somewhat better. With a lot of education, it's even better. And with even more education, it's better still. In Sweden, for example, people with PhDs have lower mortality than those with a master's degree. And people with a master's degree or professional degree are not poor. In fact, those with professional degrees are richer than those with PhDs. And yet the PhDs have lower mortality than those with a professional degree. So we're not dealing only with poverty, important as that is. Mm. We're dealing with the social gradient, relative inequalities.
What is the mechanism? I mean, do we know what is happening inside our body?
In a sense, how does this get under the skin?
Mm.
Now, I think there perhaps three ways to think about it. The first is exposure to environmental hazards, and they may be physical hazards, they may be biological hazards, so it may be pollution, it may be infections, and they tend to follow the social gradient. The second is lifestyle, that your position in the hierarchy influences your behavior. So I don't blame people for smoking. When I see a social gradient in smoking, I say we need to understand why is it the lower you are in the hierarchy, the more likely you are to smoke. So we need to address the causes of the causes. And thirdly, the most interesting organ, or what Woody Allen called the second most interesting organ, is the brain.
Mm.
And the brain is an important gateway by which the social environment impacts on people's health. Through the mind. There's good evidence that if people are disempowered, if they have little control over their lives, if they're socially isolated or unable to participate fully in society, then there are biological effects. A recent study that you may have seen was published about a month ago in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This study in female rhesus macaques,
the monkeys,
manipulated status. I mean, one of the questions has been, does your health determine your status or does your status determine your health? At least in these monkeys and these rhesus macaques, they could manipulate that because it turns out there's a high correlation between the order in which a monkey is introduced into a group and the rank. So the monkey that's there first is the top rank, and the monkey that enters the group second is the next rank, and so on. So they could manipulate the rank of the monkeys by the order in which they introduce them into the group. And what they showed, they examined several hundred genes, and what they showed was the rank of the monkey affected gene expression in a number of interesting pathways, including immune function. So to come back to the question you asked me right at the beginning, is it genes or environment? Well, they interact, and the environment can actually affect gene expression.
Yes, but it seems to be saying, that study, that your status determines your health rather than the other way around.
Which is what I've been saying for the last 35 years.
You've said that health is a good marker of how society is going. So given the health of Indigenous Australians, how is Australia going?
What we see when we compare the health of Indigenous Australians with non-Indigenous Australians is marked inequalities. And that tells you something about Australia. Australia is a very healthy country, which goes along with the fact that it's very high on the Human Development Index, high wealth, good levels of education. So Australia ranks right up there, second or third on the Human Development Index. And Indigenous Australians, if you treated them as if they were a separate country, would rank probably about 100th or below 100. So you've got this incredible inequality, which of course tells you that there are huge social and economic inequalities, that the differences between Indigenous and not Indigenous Australians can be easily attributed not to differences in their genes, but to differences in the conditions in which they're born, grow, live, work, and age. In other words, to the social determinants of health.
That, of course, has been taken on by governments, especially in the last few years, with this idea of closing the gap in life expectancy. And there has been some progress, I think, not very much, but some in that. How can we do better?
The first thing I would say is that solutions cooked up in Canberra, Sydney, or Melbourne will fail, guaranteed. That we cannot decide what's best for a community several thousand kilometres away and expect that to work with the best will in the world. One of the things that we said in the WHO Commission on Social Determinants of Health is that empowerment of individuals and communities is absolutely central. Getting the community involved in organising their own destiny has got to be a key part of it.
I want to ask you about the difficulties posed by the stringent financial times we live in. The Australian government's just brought out a pretty tight budget. And of course, in Europe and North America, it's been much more fiscally constrained for a lot longer. That presents problems, doesn't it, when it comes to developing policy that you believe will work, but it may not be easy to afford?
Well, we cannot afford not to do it. For example, estimates from North America suggest that for every dollar spent on early child development, you save $7 over the life course, because children with better early child development are less likely to end up delinquent, involved in crime, unemployed, and so on. So saying we can't afford to invest in early child development means we're storing up bigger costs in the future.
But politicians have to work in the here and now more than the future. They're constrained.
I don't have to work in the here and now, and my job is to produce the best evidence. If the politicians don't want to listen to it, then we live in a democracy and the politicians we elect, and that's the way it is. But my job is to produce the best evidence and the best arguments based on that evidence. Look at Europe. Look what's going on at Europe. We've had governments right across Europe saying the solution to the financial crisis is more austerity. If the economists are arguing as to whether we need to cut or stimulate, because they're completely opposite policies, and they can't work it out, then I would say, let us work it out for you. Let's look at the lives people are able to lead, the effect of policies on the lives people are able to lead, and hence the likely effect on health and health inequalities. So it comes back to your earlier question. Health and health inequalities tell us a great deal about the good or bad effects of social policies. Now, if we're pursuing a set of policies that throws young people out of school onto the scrap heap, when we have more than 50% youth unemployment in Spain, we thought it was unacceptably high in the UK at around 25% of youth unemployment. But right across Europe, these policies have to be unacceptable. Throwing young people on the scrap heap is a public health emergency.
This is Sunday Profile with me, Richard Ady. My guest today is the doctor and epidemiologist Sir Michael Marmot, a man who's done more than anyone else to underline what are called the social determinants of health, so poverty and educational attainment and status. The last time I spoke to you, Sir Michael, you just released the Marmot Review, which was a measure of health inequality in the UK. 2 years on, there's actually more inequality.
Firstly, we don't expect health inequalities to narrow dramatically. You don't release a report and suddenly health inequalities get abolished. My report, which was, I have to say, commissioned by a Labour government, but embraced by a Conservative-led coalition government in Britain. The Conservative-led coalition government issued a public health white paper saying that we have to put reduction of health inequalities at the centre of our public health strategy, and that will require action on the social determinants of health. Now, that has to be set against the fiscal policy that they've been pursuing, which potentially will have damaging effects on people's health because it affects the lives people are able to lead. But, and it's an important but, although the central government in Britain has in theory embraced it, but what's got to weigh it up against fiscal policy, local areas in Britain have adopted my review with enthusiasm, starting with the Mayor of London, with Birmingham, with Liverpool, with Coventry, all around the country. Local government is preparing implementation plans. So, yes, we want central government to get involved. Yes, we'd like them to pursue fiscal strategies that would benefit health inequalities. But the fact that we're getting local government engaged is really very encouraging.
You have always been very careful not to be political, but it must be frustrating sometimes when you present evidence, which an enormous amount of work has gone into obtaining, and the decision makers mostly don't do very much with it.
Well, I think the aim of doing the kind of work I do and bringing the evidence to bear is to become part of the discourse. One does not see, or very rarely does one see, a one-to-one link between a review of the evidence and policies to address it. My experience of trying to influence policymakers, the first time I put evidence in front of them and they didn't do it, I thought, this is terrible. How can they ignore the evidence? Now I think my job is to continue to produce the evidence, to put it before them, to try and influence policymakers. But our elected politicians do what they judge is the right thing to do. And if we disagree, then I'll show them the evidence of why I disagree.
You're able to do that more and more now. I mean, you're very much the leader in this field. You're world-renowned, your research, and the tide is with you, if I could put it that way. But it wasn't always like that. I mean, you spent years really swimming upstream. I'm wondering what sustained you in that time.
Well, it's interesting. In Britain for 18 years from the time Mrs. Thatcher was elected till the time Tony Blair was elected, for 18 years, the government of the day said, we do not want to know about health inequalities. So what I was doing was pure research. There were no applications of the research. So what sustained me was the fun, I mean, the sheer intellectual joy of doing research, which I did a lot of during that time. Published lots of papers, got lots of research grants, talked to interesting colleagues. The academic life is wonderful. That's why people love to do research, and I loved it. It was great. And then the government changed. And from one day to the next, yesterday's pure research became today's applied research. Suddenly they were asking, what if we took this seriously? Some of the things that sustained me is that when I was commissioned, the Marmot Review in England, when I was commissioned to do that by a Labour government, it was reasonable to speculate, and a lot of people did speculate, that we'd have the same experience as happened way back in 1979 when Mrs. Thatcher got elected and said, I don't want to know anything about health inequalities, and suppressed what was called the Black Report on health inequalities. And people said Marmot would go the way of Black. But my report did not. A Conservative-led government said, we will not try and sweep health inequalities under the carpet. We'll try and address them. Now, I'm somewhat critical of the degree to which they're doing it, but they didn't try and sweep it under the carpet. So to come back to your question, I was sustained by the sheer fun, joy of doing research, the intellectual inquiry, and now the challenge of trying to formulate policy.
What got you into this, Michael? Because you really could have spent the last 40 years being a doctor in Sydney.
I could. And it was interesting. I was enjoying clinical medicine in Sydney. I liked the contact with the patients. It was intellectually stimulating, and it was rewarding treating people and seeing them get better. And then I looked at these patients that we treated and got better, and back they come. I was working in cardiorespiratory disease, so we'd see patients with cardiac disease, we'd patch them up, send them home, and back they'd come. Patients with asthma or chronic obstructive airways disease, we'd patch them up, send them home, back they'd come. And I kept thinking, there's got to be a better way than this. Shouldn't we be trying to prevent these illnesses? And then a consultant chest physician said, I've got just the thing for you. It's called epidemiology. I said, what's that? He said, well, I went to this meeting and these fantastic guys work together, doctors and statisticians and anthropologists, and they look at how people's disease rates vary depending on where they live and the circumstances in which they live. I think it's for you. So I applied for and was accepted to do a PhD in epidemiology at the University of California, Berkeley. And people said to me darkly in Sydney, you mean you're going to turn down the offer of being a medical registrar? Big mistake. Big mistake. Your career will never recover. Once you get off the ladder, you'll never get back on. I thanked them for that advice and made the big mistake and went off to Berkeley, and I've loved it ever since.
You've been away a long time, actually. I know you come back fairly often, but how do you feel about Australia? I know that members of your family are here.
Yeah, I love Australia. I mean, it's, how can you not? It's an incredibly beautiful country. I like the people. I like the country. I love it. I mean, it's wonderful. But I was given more opportunities to do the kind of work I wanted to do in the United States and in London than I was given in Australia. So I'd always assumed I would come back to Australia. But at the time I was ready, there didn't seem to be opportunities, and I was being given opportunities elsewhere. So I took them, and then, as people say, you know the thing about life, one thing leads to another. And so I ended up staying in London.
Well, I suppose I'm wondering how you see yourself. Are you an Australian expatriate, or are you something different?
Well, I was born in North London,
mm.
migrated to Australia when I was four. So when I first came to Australia, people saw me as a little English boy. Over the years, that feeling of being a little English boy diminished, and I felt much more Australian. Then I went off to Berkeley, and they had a bit of trouble distinguishing between Australia, England. It was all the same thing. That's kind of British. You speak with an accent, and they weren't very good at distinguishing the accents, so it was kind of British. Then I went to the UK, and they'd listen to me talk, and they'd say, "You're not quite the full ticket, are you?" But as one of my family in the UK, and I have a very large extended family in the UK, heard me on radio or television, and she said, "Very interesting listening to you in Britain, because your accent is classless. People can't place you. You don't fit in the class hierarchy." And I think I quite like that.
You're also Jewish. How important is that in your identity?
It's very important to me, and in a way part of how I felt in Sydney. Firstly, I was a little English boy, but I was also Jewish. I came from a warm Jewish family. I was asked recently by the Reform Rabbinical College in London. They have an annual lecture where they invite people who are Jewish, who are doing important things out in the big wide world, to reflect on whether they were influenced by their Jewish background. And so I asked the question, was my Jewish background an influence on what I was doing out in the big wide world, and my passion for social justice? Could I attribute that to my Jewish background, or was I just retrofitting Jewish values? And the answer I got was, it's highly likely that what you're doing is indeed influenced by your Jewish background. So I'm not an Orthodox Jew. I don't practice much in the way of Jewish religion, but I am very Jewish, and I think it probably does indeed influence what I do.
You're, I think, 67 now, but you're not slowing down. You're, in fact, you seem increasingly busy.
I think I am increasingly busy. I mean, it seems to me that I have a responsibility to do it, that I've pursued a lifetime in the research on social determinants of health, and more recently been packaging not just my research, but global research on this topic in a way that I hope will influence policy. And part of the job is telling people about it. And if people want me to go around and talk to governments and others, then I feel that responsibility, which is why I am on the road a good deal of the time and why I'm not slowing down.
Well, thank you for talking to me today.
It's been a pleasure.
Sir Michael Marmot's Professor of Epidemiology and Director of the International Institute of Society and Health at University College London. If you want a transcript of today's interview or to get the audio, go to the website abc.net.au/Radio National. The program is produced by Belinda Sommer. I'm Richard Adie. Talk to you next week.